I wanted to talk tonight about a subject which is very close to my heart, and I think for anyone who is really determined that they come to understanding enlightenment as soon as possible, then it's very much something that you need to bear in mind and know about. In the Buddha's teaching, the Pali expression for it is kalyanamitta, and that's usually translated as something along the lines of spiritual friend or a good friend. To try and create the picture for you, I've got a story from the commentaries from the Pali Canon. Upatissa was in search of a teaching of deliverance from suffering. His very best friend, Kulita, shared the same wish. Together they toured all of India on foot, in a vain effort to find a spiritual guide. Eventually, the two friends decided to search separately in order to double their chances. They made a pact that whoever should find the true teaching first would immediately go and let the other know. One day, Upatissa saw a recluse called Asaji walking on alms round. He was forcibly struck by the monk's countenance. He was dignified and serene, and his complexion was bright and pure. Convinced that he had discovered an enlightened sage, Upatissa discreetly followed him. The monk finished collecting his alms food and was looking for somewhere to eat. Upatissa respectfully approached the monk and proceeded to fulfill the duties of a pupil towards his teacher. He laid out a sitting cloth on which the monk sat, and after he had eaten, Upatissa served him with water from his own water container. After a polite introduction, Upatissa asked Asaji whose teaching the monk professed, and what was the teaching he proclaimed. Asaji's reply was to change Upatissa's life forever. He simply uttered this four-line stanza. Of those things that arise from a cause, the Tathagata has told the cause, and also what their cessation is. This is the doctrine of the great recluse. Upon hearing the first two lines, there arose in Upatissa the dust-free, stainless vision of the Tamma, the first glimpse of the deathless Nibbana. The last two lines he listened to as a stream winner. Upatissa then went off to find his friend Kalita, and repeated the same stanza to him. By the time he had recited the verse, Kulita too was established in the fruit of stream entry. Together the friends then went to be with that great recluse. It's an amazing story. What you have here are good friends helping each other out tremendously. Clearly, Upatissa and Kulita were very good friends. Asaji was a very good friend to Upatissa. And the great recluse, the Buddha, of course, was a good friend to everyone. What is a good friend? Someone who has our very best interests at heart. The Buddha described a good friend thus: "Monk, a friend endowed with seven qualities is worth associating with. Which seven? He gives what is hard to give. He does what is hard to do. He endures what is hard to endure. He reveals his secrets to you. He keeps your secrets. When misfortune strikes, he doesn't abandon you. When you're down and out, he doesn't look down on you. A friend endowed with these seven qualities is worth associating with." Anyone with those seven qualities would, of course, be a wonderful friend to have. And indeed, anyone who comes along and enters upon a spiritual training, such as we have done here, does possess those qualities and develops those qualities as they're going along. Indeed, you could say that all of us, the Sangha, who meet together like this on a Wednesday are all good friends. They fit the criteria. For instance, when somebody first comes along, we elect a dumber friend to look after them. That's good friendship, clearly. The greatest friend of all has to be the Buddha himself, for without the teaching, none of this would be possible at all. The Buddha described himself as being a good friend. He said this: "It is in dependence on me as a good friend that beings subject to birth have gained release from birth, that beings subject to aging, death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, distress, and despair have gained release from aging, death, sorrow, lamentation, pain, distress, and despair." Elsewhere, though, he does recognize that noble friendship means not only associating with good people, but also learning from them and emulating their good qualities. Why do we need a good friend? We need a good friend in this teaching because we wish to free ourselves from suffering. If we really want to free ourselves from suffering, we need a good friend. Why? Because we don't know the way. I must assume that if you do know the way, well, really, why are you here? Because if you knew the way, you'd just go there, and that would be the end of it. What is it that gets in the way? What gets in the way is that all unenlightened beings are prone to one thing. They're prone to ignorance, the tendency to ignore. It's a volitional action, it's a choosing. We choose not to see what's there. And what is it that we turn away from? It's simply reality. We turn away from reality. A good friend is there in order to help us, guide us, encourage us, convince us to stop ignoring reality and to look at it. Anyone who does simply just look at reality, free from any bias, will realize the truth. And the whole purpose of this teaching is to bring that person to that moment when they just peer straight into reality, straight into the mystery, free from any bias, free from any self-concern, free from any views, and just observe reality. But that tendency, that ignorance, goes very, very deep. We have hidden biases, and the tendency is that we keep on making the same mistakes. We need someone to be there to tell us that we're keeping on making mistakes. If you imagine someone in a boat having two oars but only ever choosing to use one oar, they'll just go around in circles. And without that good friend to notify us when we're going around in circles, we'll just continue to go around in circles. Hence the need for a good friend. Now, the best possible friend you could get is the Buddha, a historical Buddha. And the people that gathered, it's generally reckoned that the people that gathered around the Buddha in his lifetime were extremely, their spiritual faculties were extremely mature. Hence why someone can listen to a four-line stanza and reach stream winning. Oh, if only it was so easy. But the only reason that was because they had developed over countless lifetimes those spiritual faculties, and they wanted to be born in the same era as a historical Buddha. We don't have a historical Buddha, but we do have people that have completed the training. Now, people who have completed the training and have the aptitude to teach make extraordinarily good kalyana mitta, spiritual friend, good friend. They understand the way completely. They've gone through the whole route. They understand the pitfalls, the pratfalls. They understand where you go wrong. Also, they don't have the biases anymore. An enlightened kalyana mitta doesn't have those biases. So when they look at a student, They're not making any judgment about that student. They're simply looking at what's there. As a consequence, sometimes it can be glaringly obvious what it is the student needs to work on, where the student needs to place their attention a little bit more. Always trying to get them back in the middle, away from the extremes, bring them back into the middle. So the very best good friend that we could possibly ask for is an enlightened teacher. But if that isn't available, then an arahant will do. If an arahant isn't available, then a non-returner will do, a once-returner will do, a stream winner will do, someone who knows the books will do. As long as they are more advanced than us, they can teach us something. Very important question is, if we have chosen to walk the path, if we have chosen to try and find the cessation of suffering, enlightenment ourselves, how do we go about finding a good friend, someone who will, who won't be afraid to tell us where we're going wrong? It's often said that the teacher appears when the student is ready. Now, to a certain extent, that's very true, but it's not. It's a little bit more complex than that. Undoubtedly, it's the case that when the search as the search progresses, we come into contact with individuals whose spiritual faculties are more mature than ours. I certainly found when I started looking, and especially when I went to India, well, really in hindsight, I realised that I met some, I don't want to say spiritually advanced, you see, because it's merely that their faculties are well developed. But I certainly met teachers, now in hindsight, I realised their faculties were well developed and they could have taught me an awful lot. But I didn't notice. I didn't notice them as teachers. The reason I didn't notice them is because, I don't want to talk about me so much, but I've started now. the reason was the degree of self-concern that was present. I was out for me. It was my spiritual enlightenment that was all important. And as we progress with the meditation, something becomes very clear, that actions, mental, verbal, or bodily actions, taken with a strong sense of self-view, tends towards ignoring. Because that self-view is always taken to try and rectify what's considered to be a problem. So there is always a tendency to turn away from reality in order to fix the problem. So you find that if there's a lot of ignorance, there's a lot of self-concern. If there's a lot of self-concern, there's a lot of ignoring. Now, as it happens, this particular meditator did still benefit from their guidance. He most certainly did, but not consciously. But he did, they definitely did have a very beneficial balancing effect on him. But what was, generally speaking, happening was there was a gradual reduction in self-concern. The more it was aware that the problem, the real problem of suffering, wasn't actually being addressed for all this dabbling. Finally, there was the recognition that I needed help. Sorry, this meditator needed help. I'll get there in the end. And that's the key area. It was the beginning of the destruction of self-concern really started at that moment, because the meditator realized that he couldn't do it alone. He needed to talk to someone. And that made a huge difference. Because when he did finally meet his teacher and he looked into those unfathomable blue eyes, having also read his books as well and been pretty convinced he was enlightened, but he noticed, the meditator noticed that this teacher was indeed the one. There was just, it's different for different people, but certainly there was just this mutual recognition that was there. The meditator went running down the hill after the meeting, happier than he'd been for years, just at this one meeting. Something had connected, and it was deeper. It was something really, really rather deep, and has stood the test of time. But everyone's different. Mahakasapa, one of the Buddha's main chief disciples, apparently simply seeing the Buddha was enough. He knew that the Buddha was his teacher. Apparently he prostrated himself and said, "The Blessed One is my teacher, I am his disciple. The Blessed One is my teacher, I am his disciple." The Buddha replied that if anyone claimed to be the teacher when Mahakasapa had done that, and they weren't the real teacher, their head would explode. Such was the level of Mahakasapa's sincerity. But it's much like Upatissa and his recognition of Asaji. He'd done enough work, the self-concern had dropped away enough for him to recognize that it was indeed the teacher. What does a good friend bring to the relationship? If we enter into a relationship with a good friend, the Kalyanamitta, what does the good friend bring to the relationship? An authentic teacher knows the territory, not just the map. If you talk to somebody who has a detailed knowledge of a map of Bath, and you ask them for directions somewhere, they can give you a very, very good and coherent explanation of what you need to do. Compare that with asking directions for somewhere in Bath to someone who actually lives in Bath, and you will get the same reply. But surely there's going to be a difference there. There's going to be an authenticity about the person who lives in Bath that the person who's just simply read the map won't have. I don't know, the traffic might have been diverted somewhere on the route, something like that, something simple like that. An authentic teacher knows the route to enlightenment because they've trodden it themselves. That's the true Kalyanamitta. So that's what you get. That's what you get from a relationship with a good friend. As I said before, if he's enlightened, he'll have no personal bias towards the student whatsoever. And that is so beneficial, because what that gives the good friend is just a real clear vision of what's going on, without there being any muddle with any personal concerns with the student. And so that means that the advice that he gives is going to be that much more accurate. It's going to be decisive if it's taken up. The good friend is also prepared to experience painful feelings. There are some times when the teacher, the guide, has to, in no uncertain terms, tell the student that they got it wrong. And that can be quite painful. It's not just painful for the student. The good friend experiences that pain too. I mean, we all know what it's like having to tell your own child off. You know, it's not done lightly, is it? You know you're going to feel bad afterwards, but you know it's in their best interest, so you're going to do it anyway. And really, it's no different between the good friend and the student. And on the same point, what I've written here is there are many ways of getting it wrong. There is only one way of getting it right. So the student has to accept, as part of the package, that we're going to get it wrong. We're going to get it wrong again and again. And we're going to experience the painful feeling of someone having to put us right again and again and again. But it's all geared towards, what it's really geared towards is getting us back in the middle, away from the extremes of self-concern, back in the middle of the path so that we can carry on walking, not continually falling into ditches on either side. The teacher has wisdom and compassion, knowing what has to be done, and really wanting to help the student achieve the desired aim. And one other point on what the Kalyanamitta brings to the relationship is that because they've finished the training, they've come to accept everything that the student is still struggling with. Doubt, craving, hatred, conceit, all manner of delusions. You can only get there by looking at all of it and coming to accept all of it and seeing that actually, even the bad stuff, even the dark stuff, isn't actually bad if you understand what's going on. So the teacher has been through the whole raft of all the emotions, all the ups and downs, and wants us to go through that too, but in order that we might become enlightened. So what does the student bring to the relationship? Well, the first thing is that we have to accept our dark side. We have to accept that we're going to go to the teacher, with craving and hatred and delusion still firmly intact. We're going to take sensual desire there, we're going to take ill will there, sloth and torpor, worry and flurry and doubt. They're all going to go to the teacher. It helps enormously to accept that that's part of the package, that we take those things to the teacher, because then it means that we can talk to the teacher about them. It's critical that we accept that we do have those states and that we're willing to discuss them with the teacher. What we also take are a certain amount of pride. We all have different aspects of pride: pride of age, pride of learning, pride of occupation, pride of years of attendance at the centre. But it's important that we accept we have that, but then choose to put it to one side in order for the relationship to grow. It's very easy for, say, somebody's in a teaching capacity, as an example, that in a one-on-one situation they will assume the dominant role, because after all they're a teacher. So it's part of people's conditioning. Difficult, but if someone's aware of their conditioning and see that they have that tendency and are able to put it to one side, then it means that there can be a flow of information. Otherwise, that can't happen. Sometimes when pride is strong and, say, a student has left a one-on-one meeting, that Frank Sinatra song, "I Did It My Way," comes into mind. It's a part of the Western conditioning, really, is self-determination. I want to do it my way. I don't want to do it the way that the teacher has advised. I want to do it my way. And a lot of the battle with meditation is really learning just to follow the instruction. It helps enormously then to lend ear, to be willing to give the teacher the teaching role. For instance, the other day there was a day off and I went for a walk, and I experienced the perfect teaching situation. It was perfect. A car drove up. There was a young couple inside. They asked me the way to a local pub. I knew the way, so I gave them the instructions. There was a brief clarification of a term I'd used. They understood what I meant. They drove off. And as far as I know, they reached their destination. Perfect. Absolutely perfect. No loss of self-esteem or anything on their parts. They got what they wanted out of the situation. But they gave the teacher the teaching role, and they accepted the learning role, and it worked perfectly. If I was to sum up this part of the talk, I'd say it's learning to let go of self-concern is the path. Treating the teacher with the proper respect, lending ear, giving accurate feedback about what's happening in the meditation, inner honesty about what's really going on, recognizing the respective teacher-student status, is all part of learning to let go of self-concern. So walking the path is not different from our relationship with the teacher. Yeah? It's important to recognize that, because the teacher is only reflecting the path, essentially. It's a mirror, and it's just showing us areas in which we need to work. It's a little bit like a header tank and a bath. The teacher is the header tank and the student is the bath. Now, if we have the header tank below the bath, water isn't going to run into the bath. If we have it on the same level as the bath, water isn't going to run into the bath. If we have it above the bath, the water is going to run into the bath. And it's exactly the same. If we want the Dhamma to flow, it needs to flow in that direction. So we need to give the respect and the status to the teacher and allow the Dhamma to flow down to us. And when it works fabulously well. Sometimes the teacher has to do a bit of this to get the student to follow the instruction. But when they do, they get the result. And actually, when that happens, you find that the relationship gets so much stronger, because there's this trust begins to become established that if I do follow the instruction, something good comes out of it. Anyway, what does the good friend get out of the relationship? One teacher suggested that he was training people up simply in order to have a decent conversation. Now, a chance to talk Dhamma is always welcome, undoubtedly. I think he was slightly tongue-in-cheek there. Really, the good friend doesn't get anything out of the relationship other than a good chat, essentially, where there's that really good flow between the student and the teacher, when there isn't that self-concern. It's wonderful. It's a really joyful experience. It's brilliant. Especially when the student starts to see things not seen before. And there's that joy that they have. It's a wonderful experience. But apart from that, they don't actually get anything out of the relationship at all. Other than perhaps that gradually as they progress in their teaching, they become more skillful as a teacher, and they learn greater discrimination to be able to see exactly what's going on, and therefore being able to give more precise and well-defined instructions. But ultimately, the responsibility always rests with the student. No one can enlighten another. I put that in just in case there's a tendency to think that it's the teacher's responsibility. The teacher's got to get me enlightened. The most a teacher can ever do is give the guidance. It's up to the individual student, and of course, we all walk the path at whatever rate and with whatever tenacity we are able. What do we get from the relationship? Personal instructions means faster development. If I go back to what I was saying about learning to let go of self-concern is the path. Our relationship with the teacher will gradually help to erase the self-concern, until there is a total flowing backwards and forwards of the information between the teacher and the student. Once that's there, the student can move very quickly, and they're developing the spiritual faculties that are required through that reduction in self-concern. Allied to that, the good friend is always trying to pull us back into the middle, away from the extremes, back into the middle ground where we can continue to walk forwards. He also becomes a trusted friend and confidant. He's someone who doesn't judge us as either good or bad. So as time goes on and you begin to realise that you can tell him anything, and really something blossoms out of that. I mean, I'm thinking about Alan again. It's just amazing. The things he's been able to teach and in that one-on-one situation, because there is that free flow, is staggering. It really is. I was with him today, and it's just awesome. I mean, it's actually a real shame that, you know, he isn't so central to the place, and you don't see him so much. 20 minutes once a week isn't enough. I want more. That's the true relationship between the teacher and the student. There's no there at all. It's just, I'm wrong, he's right, that's the way it works. And it works brilliantly, beautifully. I'm going to go over, but I think this next point is an important one to make. It's not possible to realise enlightenment without shedding tears at some point in our journey. It just is not possible. If you can hide your tears from your teacher, you're not yet ready. On the journey to enlightenment, the good friend's task is always to stand just ahead of where we are, offering instructions and inspiring us to come and join him. He happily bides his time waiting for the student to catch up, only to move on again the moment we get near. Always one step ahead, he gently guides us towards the goal. Over time, the relationship between teacher and student develops into a mutual sharing of the joys and delights of walking this wonderful path. The teacher, knowing the trials and tribulations the student must go through, does his best to help show the right way. When the student makes discoveries, gains insights into reality, when he or she experiences the joy of seeing what was not seen before, the teacher feels that same joy. And when the journey is finally over and the bliss and peace of Nibbana is realized, the meditator turns his mind back and reviews the journey over which he has come. He has traveled from the depths of despair to the bliss of emancipation from suffering. He recalls that on his journey he met and learned so much from so many people. Even those who were his harshest critics, even they were his teachers. He realizes now quite how many good friends he has known, and how impossible coming to realization would have been without their influence. He realizes that all the time it is life that is the real teacher. Life wants us all to wake up to whom and what we really are, to return from the cold, barren wastelands of separation and egotism, to realize the utter peace and security of our true nature. The physical presence of a human guide is provided by life to help the student along the way. The good friend is there to instruct, inspire, console, admonish, and even if necessary, shout in order to propel us along the path back home. Thank you.